Be good.
Well, hello there. Welcome to the show. It's Andrew, and I got a great program for you today. It is a rerun, but it's a damn good one. It's with my friend Dr. Carl Schock. Dr. Carl is an adventurer, an oceanographer, a scientist, a world traveler, an explorer, a just all-around tough, smart, compassionate, curious man. I met him cycling along the West Coast. Tiffany, my dog Pele, and I were riding our bicycles from Canada to our house in Marin County, and we met him along the way. Since then, he completed that journey, made it all the way to Mexico, then rode from somewhere in central Canada all the way to Mexico along the Continental Divide, and now he is planning, preparing, training to kayak from Skagway, Alaska, along the Inside Passage to his house in Vancouver, BC. It's incredible. He's such a wealth of great stories. Every time I talk to the guy, I feel like I learn something. He's running a really cool thing that you can check out. It's called coastview.org. He's going to talk about it in this episode. I'll put up links in the show notes. Oh, and there's a tracker where you can follow along his journey when he does the kayak thing. So yeah, Dr. Carl, you know, you may say, oh, great, Andrew, you're already doing reruns. You're not even 10 episodes into your show here and you're already rerunning. What's going on? Look, man, sometimes people cancel, all right? I can't help that. People cancel, and I needed something, and I'm fortunate. I'm blessed. I am absolutely the luckiest guy ever to have a conversation like this sitting in a WAV file that I could reconstitute and share with you. And that's what this is. It's a chat between me and Dr. Carl with some guitar licks woven in because I didn't have a microphone on me when I recorded him, and I put in my questions after the fact. Anyway, it doesn't matter. I hope you like it. I certainly did. And if you've got questions or comments or concerns, send us a note, mtp.dog/contact. I'll answer your questions. You got a friend who's interesting that you might want to hear on this show? Send them my way. I want to know all about it, especially if they're not prone to canceling. Okay, have fun. Do interesting things. Until next time, here's my conversation with Dr. Carl Schock.
The original intent back when I was in undergrad was to go into marine biology, but at that time, that was only a graduate degree. There was no such thing as an undergraduate in marine biology. So I decided I would, and I was not taking well to biology classes, just straight biology classes. What I did really enjoy was the physical sciences. So I went into geology first, and then that just ended. But then, of course, my career started, and the first thing I did was became a commercial diver. I went to commercial diving school. And the reason for that was at the time, probably still so to some degree, commercial divers used to make a lot of money because their work was dangerous. And it wasn't the danger part that intrigued me, was the money. I had huge college debts to pay off. And so the only way to do that was to get a good paying job. But geology at the time was tanking, because oil prices were plummeting and there was no more exploration for minerals. And so there was no work at all in geology. So, I mean, I had few options. I mean, where do I go to make a lot of money? And I've always liked the ocean. I always wanted to go and make a living on the ocean, but I didn't quite have it sorted out doing what do I do? So I went to commercial diving school, and that then evolved into a job in Seattle, first as a salvage diver. And then that wasn't making enough money. So I went to the Gulf of Mexico and I lived in Louisiana, in Houma, for 2 years working for a company called Santa Fe Engineering as a commercial diver. And that then led to another job with a company called Ocean Systems out of Galveston, and they sent me to Colombia. And there was a drilling ship operating off the coast of Colombia. I was actually working for Venezuela under the company Citgo at the time. And they needed a diver support team to monitor the wellhead. And there were one, two, three, four, five of us, with it, including a dive supervisor. And we were on a rotation. And it was a very mundane task. We were suited up and sent down. The dive depth was 352 feet. So we were on helium, so on a mixed gas, because oxygen at that depth is poisonous. So they, and so is nitrogen. So they reduced the amount of oxygen and they eliminate nitrogen entirely and replace it with helium. So you've heard the divers talking, the Donald Duck voice, that's the helium. It's a very light gas. Helium is a much smaller molecule than nitrogen. And what happens is that it is dissolved in your bloodstream under pressure. But as you come out of pressure, it starts creating bubbles. So the helium molecules will start adhering to one another until finally there's actually a bubble. And then the bubble, as pressure is still decreasing, will start getting larger. And of course, it's just like a blood clot at that point. It travels with your blood and eventually gets lodged someplace and you end up with either a cardiac arrest or a stroke. That's in the short term. In the long term, it turns out that happens anyway because they haven't actually developed decompression tables, especially industry. The Navy has done a pretty good job with this, but in industry it's a somewhat different story where a lot of companies make their own decompression tables because it's cheaper. They typically shorten the decompression time or change the schedule a little bit. And a lot of divers, it doesn't happen so much anymore, but a lot of the old time divers ended up with a disease called, it's a bone necrosis. It starts to destroy your long bones because the bubbles eventually get lodged in your bone tissue. And it takes 10 or 20 years for that to come out. But as it comes out, it starts to break up the bones itself. Anyway, so on our dive rotation, we were sent down to do things like pick up a wrench that was dropped or look for the cement that was escaping from the casing as they pumped the cement in to seal the well. So all these banal tasks. And then one day, there was this massive explosion on the drilling ship. And we trained for this, and apparently it happens from time to time. But if they don't pump enough cement into the hole or drilling mud into the hole to contain the pressurized gas that they eventually hit as they're drilling, that gas escapes up through the casing, and bubbles come up, shoot to the surface. And the problem with the drilling ship is Archimedes says that, it doesn't float in an aerated water. It starts to sink. And so that becomes a major emergency for the ship. So that's what happened. The blowout preventers failed. And there was this phenomenal volume of gas rising up through the water column to the point where they had to move the ship off of the well head. So the blowout preventers did cut the drill string, and then they positioned the ship off to the side. The ship is anchored. There are four massive anchors in the bow, four more in the stern. And then it's tethered to the wellhead with gigantic steel cables, maybe 1.5 to 2 inches in diameter. And so they just let those go slack as the ship pulled off. They called the dive team in because our job was to place an explosive in the wellhead and then lower it to a depth where when they ignited the explosives, it would collapse the rock strata and seal off the hole. That was the grand plan. This is where things get very dangerous, right? So it goes from this very mundane, oh, go pick up this wrench because we dropped it yesterday, to packing this wellhead full of high explosives. So our dive supervisor, as it turns out, was an ex-Scot Marine. I'm not sure what their equivalent is of special forces, but that's what he was. And he knew how to make explosives. So he ordered from shore 55-gallon drums full of nitrate and kerosene. It's a basic standard recipe. And he made the explosive. And it was put onto a pallet. And fortunately, during this time, I was on rotation, but I was like third or fourth in line. So other divers went down and they placed the explosive. They lowered it into the wellhead and the ship pulled off and they ignited it. And then what happened at that point was the structure that was on the bottom is called a wellhead. It's very expensive, like $150,000. It's this massive steel grate platform that might measure 20 feet on a side. And it has posts. It's an octagon, and it has posts on each of the corners where the blowout preventer would use guides to sit down and sit on top of this platform. Well, the blowout preventer was gone, and when they exploded the high explosives, it did in fact seal the well, and no more gas came out. But the wellhead had, of course, been blown off of the casing, and it was falling up to the side. What's interesting about this part of the coast of Venezuela is that there is no substantial bottom. It's just mud that gets more and more dense. So it's not like you go to the bottom and there's something to stand on. No, you go to the bottom and you just gradually sink into mud. It's probably a lot like the Mississippi Delta, right? Where it's just nothing really substantial there to stand on. So my job, which sounds very simple now that we're talking about it, was to take down a four-point a sling. So it's a wire harness, which has a massive shackle on each of each one of four legs. And I had to shackle this this sling to pad eyes that were welded to the this wellhead. Now, this wellhead is now fallen off to the side. So what was at one point a horizontal platform is now a near vertical platform, and it's sinking into the mud. But still wires attached to it and to the ship. So all I had to do was follow the wires down, and I could then find the platform. Now, keep in mind that at a depth of 352 feet, it's dark. I mean, it's so dark that you cannot imagine the blackness. Your brain starts to imagine things that aren't there. And so what they do to avoid this distraction to the divers, they typically duct tape over your faceplate so you can't see anything. So if you think you're seeing something, your brain's saying, you can't see anything because it's duct taped over. Okay, more on that later. So there is a diving bell that we have, and we have an on-deck decompression chamber for emergencies and for extended dive times to decompress the diver. In this case, I was sent over in a cage that they lowered to near working depth, and then I just swam the remaining distance. So I'm tethered to the surface, so it's this massive umbilical cable that contains hot water for my hot water suit, a communication cable, a stainless steel lifeline, and of course the gas mixture. All that goes all the way up to the surface. They also lower a diving bell, which is only used in emergency. In the diving bell, there is a dive tender and an emergency standby diver. His job is, in case anything happens to me, you would think he goes and rescues me. No, his job is to finish the job. But the diving bell does have lights. That's the only working lights available because everything else has been severed to the wellhead. So they lower me in the cage. I swim down out of the cage and I follow these 2-inch steel cables to the wellhead. And now at this point, it's all done by touch, right? You can't see anything. So you've memorized the configuration of this wellhead and where the pad eyes are and so forth. And so it's all done by feel. And I finally, it took a while, but I found the first pad eye and I managed to get the shackle bolted into the pad eye. And then I went and I swam to the second, once I knew where one was, I knew where the other ones were. So I went to the left and I swam to the next pad eye. And at that point, I started feeling like this tremendous weight, like it's becoming very difficult for me to move. And it's because this wellhead is sinking into mud and it's becoming sort of like a thick cement mixture, right? So it's so viscous that I'm having trouble just moving my arms and legs. But I get that second shackle bolted in and I then work my way to the third one, which is deeper down. And so at this point, I'm pulling myself, we're using my fingers in the steel grate, pulling myself down, and I find a third pad eye out of four, and I shackle it in, but the thread of the shackle now is so gummed up with mud that I can only get the pin in about halfway. And I'm talking to the dive supervisor this whole time, and he said, halfway, the engineer says, that's good enough. Go find the fourth one. Well, I say, okay, how am I doing on dive time? He said, you're 10 minutes past your dive time, but we want this wellhead back. So we've extended your bottom time, which is bad news, right? Because that means that my decompression time now has gone from 30 minutes to 6 hours. So I know where the fourth pad eye is, but I can't find it. I've become so disoriented because of the mud, and there's now a tangle of umbilical cord down there. And they finally call it off, and they say, never mind, we'll just pull it up with three legs of the sling attached. And I said, are you sure? He said, yeah, we're going to do this. And I said, okay, I'm out of here. I said, okay, yeah, you can try to swim out. I said, you know, I can't move anymore. And they then called the standby diver, and he swam over, and they turned the lights on the diving bell. And all they see at this point is these 2-inch steel cables just disappearing into the mud. I mean, everything else is gone. And so they decide to take tension on the sling anyway. And so the crane gets activated and they tighten up the wire, and I can feel the four legs of the sling starting to take tension. And then there is just this overwhelming, crushing feeling, like I can't even inhale, as they're pulling this wellhead up through the mud. And the standby diver is videoing this whole thing, and what they are seeing is the lights are illuminating the scene of mud just boiling in mushroom clouds from the bottom. And then this steel platform emerges, and he said it looked like I was like a squashed bug sitting on top of this deck grating. And the reason I couldn't move is because my umbilical cord was completely wrapped around one of the steel guideposts. So there was no way I was ever going to get out by myself. So at that point, he was given permission to go and unravel me. And then after that, I started this long arc. They just let the wellhead just hang there while they got me out. And I went into the diving bell. So there were then three of us in there, and they moved it up and they made it to the decompression chamber. And then I got into the decompression chamber with the standby diver. He got out in 30 minutes, and I was there for, I don't know, 6 or 8 hours. Yeah, under medical observation, because they thought I was going to expire. After that was my last commercial dive, and I went to the mountains, and I worked for the U.S. Geological Survey making topographic maps. So I wanted to be anywhere but the ocean, at that point anyway. And I was hired in Denver, and they sent me to all the western states during the summer, and then way down south in New Mexico and Arizona during the winter. And then the next year, they sent me to Alaska, which is where I ended up staying for 30 years. So the sailing trip started giving me a lot of ideas, mostly asking questions about how things in the ocean worked. I was very curious while I was sailing about the winds, the atmospheric currents. I was interested in how they drove ocean currents and what happens to those ocean currents over time. And so that pointed me in the direction of oceanography, because that's what oceanography is. But I was also very interested in how those physical properties of the ocean affect the biological organisms that live in the water column. That became more of a conundrum over time, because it's very expensive to do that type of oceanography, because it's always at sea on large ships. And I needed something to test my questions. I needed something that was closer at hand. So I started working in the intertidal zone. And in particular, what I was interested in is this, what's now called the White Gap. It's this it's this margin between the land and the ocean that we know very little about, because the water depth keeps boats from getting in there, and yet it's too deep for people to wade out. So it's this place where we really don't know very much about. So on a lot of charts, it's this data gap, and oftentimes it's depicted as a white zone where there's no data, there's no bathymetry, and we know very little about the marine biology, and we especially don't know very much about how the ocean waves, the energy in the ocean waves dissipates as it arrives on shore.
So for those of us who might not know or may have forgotten, can you tell me how wind works?
So wind works by always flowing from a high pressure to a low pressure. So when we listen to the weatherman, they often talk about high pressure centers and low pressure centers. And high pressure centers are where air is descending from a high altitude to a low altitude. And a low pressure is just the opposite. It's where warm air is rising from basically sea level to high elevations. And it's that flow from high centers to low centers that creates wind. And we're seeing that now as an effect of climate change, because the polar regions, the North Pole and the South Pole, have been for a very long time very stable high pressure centers where cold air is descending to the Earth's surface. And of course, the equator is where the air is warming up and is constantly rising. That's why low pressure centers are often equated with hurricanes. Hurricanes are massive low pressure centers that evolve in the equatorial regions. And so if the Earth was not revolving, if it was just a static orb, the air would be flowing from the poles to the equator. But because the Earth is rotating, then we enter this phenomenon called Coriolis, which causes airflow to curve to the right in the northern hemisphere and to the left in the southern hemisphere. And so that then breaks down into not one circulation cell from the polar regions to the equatorial regions, but in three different circulation cells. So there's a high latitude, a middle latitude, and a low latitude circulation cell. And that's where we have the trade winds, for example, in the low latitudes. And in the northern hemisphere, the trade winds are typically from the northeast to the southwest. Yes, so after the sailing trip, I decided I had to go back and learn more about what I had just been observing for 3 years. So I entered an oceanography program at Oregon State University. In the place that I'm studying, it's mostly about waves. So the waves are often generated far out at sea by wind. And depending on the wind velocity, so higher wind velocities make bigger waves, and those bigger waves typically have a longer wavelength. And it's those long wavelength waves that end up crashing on our shore, and we hear that as the surf beat, you know, in the background that we all like to listen to at night. Well, what those waves do when they arrive to shore is very important to what I study, because on a steep shoreline, a lot of the energy in the wave is maintained until it breaks on shore. We call that a shore break, or, you know, on cliffs, it actually reflects off the cliff and bounces back out to sea, where we see these haystacks forming. You know, you've probably seen that. It's very cool when a wave coming from the ocean interacts with a wave coming, bouncing off a cliff and coming back from shore, explode into this haystack. More typically though, the shoreline has a slope, and off the coast of Oregon, for example, there are some classic examples, Washington too, where the slope angle is very, very low, almost flat. And so the surf zone starts a mile out at sea, where the waves start peaking up and they start losing their energy as they approach shore, to the point where you can walk on the beach and all you see is this gentle lapping of the surf, you know, coming up the shoreline. So those are typically very protected shorelines where you can expect to see a very certain subset of all the shallow water plants and animals. Steeper shorelines have a different suite of plants and animals that prefer that environment. And so what I'm interested in is exactly what type of oceanic conditions dictate what lives on the rocks in the surf zone. And you can actually model this. So if you know what the physical attributes are, you can actually model and predict to some extent what lives there.
Before you showed up, was there anyone else working on this?
Oh, I'm sure. And you know, there's a lot of literature out there. The question was typically posed slightly differently. And people would do lots of experiments, for example, looking at how intertidal invertebrates like mussels and barnacles, how their growth rate might be affected by wave energy, how their growth rate might be affected by the sand that's entrained in the water column in high energy wave environments versus low energy wave environments. So the question is always slightly different. But in the end, people have been actually looking at how the physical ocean dictates marine life for a very long time. But nobody's ever tried to predict it. I was involved in the response to the Exxon Valdez oil spill in Alaska. And the story there is I was working with some marine biologists who were hired to look at what lived on the shorelines in advance of this oil spill that was coming out of Prince William Sound. And this was a project initiated by the Park Service for Kenai Fjords and for Katmai National Parks. And the people that worked there, the local people, knew that the oil was about to arrive on their shoreline, and they felt absolutely helpless in doing anything about it. And yet it was a certainty. And there had been so little baseline studies done on that shoreline that they hired marine biologists to give them an inventory of what lives there so that they knew what was there before the spill versus after the oil arrived. So we spent weeks out there carefully measuring and taking inventories of the plants and animals that lived on these different types of shoreline. And then a storm came up and it blew the oil offshore. And then when the oil came back, it landed in places that were never inventoried. Right. So you would roll your eyes and say, oh, well, that was all for nothing. So, but that's where the first question that I had came into play, because I was looking at shorelines that we had inventoried. And to me, they looked identical to the shorelines that we did not inventory, but were oiled. And so in my thinking, it's like, well, why can't we take the inventory from this unoiled shoreline and just superimpose it and say, well, if these plants and animals live there, and if that environment is exactly the same as the one that was oiled, how come we can't say that those plants and animals live there too? So that was the test. Nobody ever asked that question before. So I set out to show that that is in fact the case, to a limit. You can't go too far away. In other words, like a few hundred meters and you're basically spot on. So that means that if a rocky shore is of this slope angle and it's this wide with this tide range and this exposure to wave energy, the other ones will have the exact same plants and animals living on it. And that was shown to be true. When you get more than a few miles away, it starts to break down. And if you're more than, say, 10 miles away, and I wouldn't have much confidence in the result.
So why the differences? Is it a matter of temperature or creeks and rivers?
Exactly. Because thank you for bringing that up, because that is often the case. It's either something to do with sand entrained in the water column or fresh water, both of which are killers to marine life. So that then launched my doctoral degree. Asking that exact question, it's called Untangling the Complexity of the Nearshore Environment. And it was basically to test this model. And the model was basically linking the physical environment to the biological organisms that live there, and to be able to predict in places that you had not visited what would live there. And I tested that in different places, in Oregon, in Washington State, and in Alaska. I was actually funded by a scholarship from NOAA, called the Nancy Foster Scholarship, which got me about halfway through. And then my advisor was funded by NASA, and he suggested I write an application for funding from a new kind of satellite program that NASA was launching called the Lewis and Clark program. Lewis and Clark were two separate satellites, and these satellites had hyperspectral sensors on board that could measure very narrow light wavelengths. And I think Lewis, which is the satellite that I worked on, had 150 different wavelengths. And what could be done with that type of measurement is we could actually attach a spectral signature to different plants and animals that live in the marine environment and then be able to sense their presence from space, which is pretty amazing. And so I worked on that for several years. And then the time came for this, for the satellite to be placed on a rocket, and it was launched from the Kennedy Space Center. Lewis was first and Clark was second. And I think they were launched about a month apart. Unfortunately, Lewis went into orbit and one of the thrusters on the satellite refused to work, and it ended up going into a spiral and re-entered the atmosphere and burned up. And so that aspect of my work never came to fruition in a practical sense, but the theoretical work was all done. And I was able to show with algorithms that that, in fact, would be a valid way to measure plants and animals that lived in the marine environment on an exposed intertidal shoreline. However, the satellite was never replaced, so we have never tested it from space. There are airborne hyperspectral sensors, which work very well, and even better, I think, than the satellite-based sensors. So we take video and still digital images. And so what that does is we're able to fly with the helicopter very low to the intertidal zone, like 100 meters in elevation, and we're off. We try to stay offset 100 meters from shore, and the helicopter pilot is instructed to just follow the shoreline as closely as possible. And we're snapping pictures one every 3 seconds. And at that configuration, so 100 meters in elevation, 100 meters offshore, at a flight speed of, say, 60 knots, and a picture interval of 3 seconds, the pictures end up overlapping by about 50%. And because they overlap, then two pictures can give us a stereoscopic three-dimensional image of the shoreline. With more, we can actually take any object on shore and create a digital three-dimensional replicate of that object. So boulders, we can tell if it's a sand beach, gravel beach, pebbles, boulders, bedrock. We can tell even what types of plants and animals live there. More importantly, because it generates this digital model of the shoreline, we can now take measurements, and very accurate measurements, of how long the beach is, how wide it is, and what its slope angle is. And so now when we're flying, we can give estimates, say, of what percent cover of this shoreline is mussels, what percent shoreline of this shoreline is algae, what type of algae, is it red algae, brown algae, green algae? And that percent cover can be then translated into a square meter area. It's very time consuming and it's very expensive. But the idea is that if we find a place that we know is undergoing change, we can go back and reimage that particular spot without having to reimage the entire shoreline. But the first pass was to try to do it all. And the coverage now actually goes all the way around Alaska, a lot of British Columbia, all of Washington, Oregon, and there is an image data set available for California as well.
Okay, so tell me about your current project. What is it and how does it operate?
So the program is called Shore Zone, and it was developed in British Columbia and then expanded first to Washington, Alaska, and Oregon. And it's almost entirely funded by NOAA, so the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, which is a U.S. federal agency. But there has also been some work in British Columbia funded by the British Columbia government. We now sit on a library of 750,000 images, still images. The idea was we didn't want any government to own their particular set of images. So we developed this consortium called ShoreZone so that all the images are put into one data library. So we try and break down the jurisdictional issues. And it has both video imagery and still imagery. But the question is, once the habitat, this white gap, has been mapped, there's really no use anymore for the images. And I felt that was a shame because every image tells a story, particularly if it's an image of a place with a name. And I became so intrigued with this idea that I started looking at the history of how these places were named and who named it and when and why. And it's actually quite astounding how many times a place like a point or a cape or a bay or a creek even, the name goes back and actually tells this intricate historical story of an event that happened in, well, a long time ago. And so I set about extracting the images that I thought were most interesting and the places that I thought were most interesting and writing a story about them. And it ended up being called Coast View. It's a project that's online. It's a digital library of now over 1,000 different stories of different places along the coast from California all the way to Alaska.
What's the ultimate goal of Coast View and how can people find it?
It's coastview.org. So www.coastview.org. Ultimately, the idea is to inform the public about these places. And yes, there is a historical component to this, especially tied into the place name. But each article also tells a little bit about the geology and about the plants and animals that depend on that particular place and why, sometimes even why they are there. And in many places, these plants and animals can only be found in those very localized locations. So the idea is to inform the public as much as possible. And partly too, it's the granularity of these stories is pretty small. We're talking about maybe 100 meters, which is what a typical image captures. And so 100 meters may not be of interest to very many people. It's too fine a scale. Unless, of course, you're traveling either by boat or by kayak or by bicycle or even by car along the coastline. And you might be intrigued by why a cape has been given that name or what types of plants and animals might be living on that particular point. And this story, this coast view will tell you what lives there. And this partly came about from sailing down the coast, from bicycling down the coast a number of times, and being a little bit frustrated because even if you're driving down the coast highway, it's actually remarkable how little of the coast you actually see from the highway. I mean, the best place to see the coast is from a helicopter flying along the beach, but we can't afford that. Most of us have different modes of transport. And so Coastview is supposed to give you this little window into what you're missing. And so, or even with some advanced planning, if you wanted to go and see a particular place, you can actually get there using Coastview. You can access the Coastview articles for free and read one article, or you can subscribe to Coastview. And there are different levels of subscription, 1 week, 1 month, or 1 year. And the 1 year gives you unlimited access for as many articles as you want to read. It also triggers a email newsletter that you get every day if you wanted to actually keep up with every article that Coastview issues.
Are you actively writing new articles?
I am actually active. I have right now the emphasis is on standardizing the article formats The first round was trying to tackle an article maybe every 100 kilometers along the coast. And that now has been done. And now I'm going back and rewriting a lot of those because they were a little bit rough in the beginning. But at the same time, by revisiting those older places, I'm discovering new places. And so every time I see a place that I now am intrigued about and want to write about, I grab the image and I set it aside. And so even though there are 1,000 articles now, there are 2,000 more articles waiting to be written in the future.
And what's the scope? The Arctic Circle to San Diego?
Yep. So the Alaska border with Canada, it's a place called Demarcation Point. And all the way around the Beaufort Sea, the Chukchi Sea, the Gulf of Alaska, down through Southeast Alaska, which is very popular with cruise ships and cruise ship passengers, British Columbia, Washington, Oregon, and then California. I mean, California, I'm using a different image set, which is almost identical to Shore Zone. And actually, California has so much accessible shoreline that there's a lot of very interesting stories to be told there.
Why is it important to you that people know these things?
I think part of it is just general information, knowing that these places exist. There, a lot of these places that I have chosen to write an article about are just outstandingly beautiful. But then typically there's also a very interesting backstory to them. And not only why do they represent a magnificent landscape, but historically why they were important. Most recently, I've been writing about very small places along the California coast where back in the mid-1800s, there were redwood lumber chutes where the pioneer loggers would cut the tree. It would be milled at a local sawmill, but there were no roads at the time or railroads. And so this lumber had to be transported to San Francisco and to overseas markets. And so they had to get this lumber out to ships at sea. And it's a very inhospitable coastline, extremely rocky, very rough waves. And they built these intricate lumber chutes that would extend out from shore, sometimes connecting offshore rocks and islands, and ending at a place where a ship could access that was deep enough water and free of rocks where they could anchor. And the lumber would even be taken out there by, it's called a skunk railroad. It's a very stinky coal-fired locomotive that would run along this tramway way out to sea. And then from there, the lumber would be lowered to the ships. So those are all now long gone. But if you were to drive along the coast, there's nothing left. There's no remnants of these intricate structures remaining. And so you can drive by and think, well, this is a lovely shoreline, but there's no knowing what the history was unless you read these articles. So that was the impetus behind starting Coast View.
So why, in your opinion, are the questions you've posed throughout your career important?
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, mind you, I still ask that same question myself now. It's like, well, what good is this to anybody? Well, the answer, there are probably many answers, but first and foremost, we need to know what was there, because we all recognize that the earth is changing in many places. The climate is warming and there's more precipitation. And so we need to understand how this climate change affects the plants and animals everywhere. But I've chosen the intertidal zone, and I'm very interested to see how these communities, these groups of plants and animals that live there change over time, particularly now that we know that the climate is changing. So originally it was just to establish a baseline. So, okay, we now know what was living there 20 years ago. We can go back at any time and measure it again and see how those places have changed over time.
Can you talk a bit about the sympathetic cause versus the more esoteric cause and why it's important to pay attention to more than just the sea creatures who happen to have a face?
Interestingly, the aspects of science that get the most money are the ones that have the most ramifications to humans. So fisheries, think salmon, get tons of money. Whales, which we have no use for anymore, get tons of money because they're charismatic. We all care about mammals in general, marine mammals in particular. So the studies of whales are very well funded. But we also realize that whales and salmon too feed on smaller animals that live in the ocean. And those smaller animals are much harder to study in some cases because they're not as plentiful. Herring, for example, and sardines used to be hugely plentiful along the coast, but we fished them down. So now they're quite scarce in many places. We also want to study the habitat where herring and sardines hang out. Herring, for example, spawn in eelgrass meadows, and we know that eelgrass meadows occur in very shallow, calm water, and it's very susceptible to pollution. So in polluted estuaries, it's difficult to find eelgrass today where once it was plentiful. There's very much a connection there between the loss of this eelgrass herring spawning habitat and the loss of herring. So herring were once abundant. They were fished down. The question for fishery biologists is, why haven't herring come back? We haven't really had big herring fisheries for a very long time, and the ones that are active are very well managed. And yet the herring don't seem to be responding to that. The answer is probably that their spawning habitat has been destroyed in many cases because of nobody realized early on what they were doing when they introduced pollutants or when they developed the shoreline. And now there is just much less habitat for a herring to spawn. And so we see that in the adult population. And so this nearshore area, this shallow water area, is some of the most productive habitat on Earth in terms of the kelp forests and the marine algae and the juvenile fishes and what are called forage fishes or forage species. Those are the animals that bigger things eat. Why that is now so important. But of course, we all want to live on the beach, right? We love seaside communities and we use the shoreline to go fishing on and build condominiums and even to some extent industrialize them because it's an easy place to export whatever it is that we're making to foreign markets. And so this nearshore environment is tragically some of the first to be exploited by humans and in the process destroyed by humans. And now we're recognizing how important that is, not only to feed up the food chain, whales and fish that are important to us, but how important that natural environment is to us directly.
Knowing what you know, are you hopeful?
That question was asked of me a couple of days ago when I visited a cousin who has a 10-year-old. And I didn't get a chance to talk with the 10-year-old directly, but I answered this question for my cousin. And she said, okay, here's a 10-year-old who is very anxious about the future of the planet and is very troubled by the changes that he is seeing either directly or reading about in books and on seeing on television. How would you answer this 10-year-old's question about how worried should he be about Earth being destroyed through population growth and through climate change? And my answer for a 10-year-old is going to be very different from my answer to you. To a 10-year-old, I would say that the Earth has always been changing. The Earth has been changing on its own, but especially through acts of humans ever since we found fire and how to make it. Because once we found fire, we were burning forests and we were burning fields and we were putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere from the fires that we learned how to make. And so we have been manipulating the Earth for a very long time. This is not new. What is new is the rate of change. And even though our grandfathers lived in a different world than we live in, and our children will live in a different world than we live in today, they will see a much greater rate of change from when they were born to when they die.
And how would you answer that question for a totally doomed 43-year-old guy?
In pretty much the same way, although in a little more dire context. What's interesting is I first learned about this phenomenon of global warming and climate change 30 years ago. It was in a textbook written by an oceanographer from Woods Hole called Walter Monk. And he even put out some ideas for solutions. But he actually had the models, he had the data, and he said, this is what's going to happen if we don't do anything about it. And so here we are 30 years later, and we haven't done anything about it. Not really, not in a meaningful sense. And now we're starting to see the ramifications of climate change. We're seeing wilder fluctuations in the jet stream, which should be of huge concern to many more people than it is. And I would wish that we all took this a little bit more seriously in terms of coming to a common ground and finding a solution to it. I'm sensing that it may already be too late. There are many things that we can do to slow it down, but it's already too late to go back to the before. We have changed things so much so quickly, and I don't see us making the changes necessary anytime soon to effectively address the problem.
Well, shit. We can't end on that note. Let's switch gears. Can you tell me a bit about your current West Coast cycling adventure?
So I first did this trip in 1985 when I was living in Alaska, and I decided I had enough for a while and I needed to do some adventuring. So I sold my house, put the bike on the plane, flew to Seattle and biked to Mexico in 21 days. And then I biked to Maine. And I had to get to Maine because I wanted to go and learn how to build wooden boats. And so that's a whole nother story, but that was the first time I did any kind of bike, long distance bike touring. But that did set in motion many other trips. So I've biked around Ireland, around Scotland. I've been all through Holland, Belgium, and France, biked in Italy. And of course, two more times down the Pacific coast, which is my favorite bike route.
And when did you start adventuring?
When I was 19, I hiked the Appalachian Trail from south to north in the course of the summer, so a little over 4 months. That was my first exposure actually to any outdoor activity. I'd never hiked anywhere before, not even for a weekend. So here is this dumb 19-year-old kid, brand new, massively heavy leather hiking boots in this huge pack. And the first month was pretty awful. But then I start getting into the routine of things, and I always start looking forward to what's around the next corner.
And what is it that keeps you, you know, a guy in his 60s, making these arduous adventures?
I think the simple answer is just curiosity. I'm very curious about places. I'm curious about how did this come to be, and why is it what I see today? And it's that last bit that I think is important, and what keeps me going is not only just self-education, and self-experience. I want to meet the people that live in these places too, and I want to learn their stories. Mostly because I know that it's all changing, and it's changing faster than any of us want it to change. So get out there and experience these things today, because it'll be different tomorrow.
Well, Carl, thank you so much for sharing your story with us, and thanks for stopping by on your way to Mexico.
Yeah, sure. My pleasure.
I've spent too long.